Well, good morning. I'd like to ask you to open your Bibles, please, to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24, and we're picking up where we were last week. Jesus talking about his return. He's talking about end times. The disciples have asked some questions. They've asked three questions. They've asked the question, when will these things happen as far as the stones coming down being pushed over in the Temple Mount? They've asked, at what time, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? The word coming is the word parousia. It's not used in Luke or not used in Mark when Jesus answers these questions. Luke and Mark seem to be more addressing the answer to the question about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. I think it's pretty clear. We could go there and look through Luke chapter 21. But it's very, very precise that he's talking about the destruction of the temple. He tells them to flee when they see Jerusalem surrounded. It's the fulfillment of all the prophecies of the Old Testament. But in Matthew, he's got that word, what is the sign of your coming? And he begins to answer that. And so in Matthew, there seems to be more of a discussion about the return of Christ, the second coming at the end of time, at the end of the age. And of course, there's always discussion about these things. And I think we should encourage those discussions. We should continue to look at other options and different theologies, or we say eschatologies, and see where we may have missed something. Because this seems to be wrapped in mystery. It's not as clear as we see like the talking about Jesus Christ being eternal God or the scriptures. This is something that is future. Jesus is very precise as he teaches us. The words are very clear. But I do want you to notice, if you look in verse 25, in verse chapter 24, verse 25, Jesus says, "See, I have told you ahead of time." I think one of the powerful things and one of the reasons for prophecy is so that when these things start to transpire, there is a divine record of them already established. It's not for our curiosity. It's not for us to try and prove who's right and who's wrong and to argue, you know, against this group or that group, although I think some groups need to be identified as being in error and some things are more accurate than others. We're going to continue to study eschatology. But when these things start to transpire and these events start to happen, these words of Jesus are going to be recorded here. The apostles' words in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, the book of Revelation, it'll all be hanging there as a divine record as things continue to transpire. Men will not be able to believe it. Just like today in many groups of Christians, they cannot accept the fact that the book of Daniel was written by Daniel, recording historical events 200-400 years in the future, and even yet in our future, and he nailed it exactly right. They got to say, well, it was written by somebody who watched those things take place. They just back way off of prophecy. And I pity those people. I was talking to someone this week. It's like, that's so sad. How important is eschatology? Some have said up to 25% of the Bible record is prophetic information. I mean, if you don't understand eschatology, or you just wipe it out and say, well, it's not important, we're not going to pay attention to it, or we think it's already been fulfilled, we don't need to worry about it. I mean, if you're in school and you reject 25% of the information, the best score you can get is 75%. The best you're going to do in your Christian life is C. And that's assuming you got everything else right. I mean, you give yourself a little bit of room for errors in other areas of theology, and you're failing your Christian life. You're failing in your understanding of Christianity. We're all got faults and defects in our understanding, but if you just wipe eschatology off the map and say, well, it's really not important, I mean, you're starting off at the best you can do is a C in Christianity. And then you add your other mistakes and you're probably failing. So again, we need to study these things. We need to look at them. But as I mentioned last week, Jesus' final words on eschatology were in Acts chapter 1 when he says, are you at this time? Let me say this again. He's gone through all of this teaching. They spent these 3 years or so with Jesus. And he's taught them Matthew 24. And within a few days, within, 5 weeks of his teaching Matthew 24, after he teaches Matthew 24, Jesus then stands on the Mount of Olives and the disciples say, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? And it's like, did you not even hear anything I said? He doesn't say that, but he says, it's not for you to know the times or dates, but you will be my witness. In other words, here's what you're going to do. And so as we read these things, understand, Jesus says, these things are not that clear as we proceed through time, and he's going to say it several times here. I want to look, first of all, today, we begin in Matthew 24, looking in verse 15. And there's a huge verse right here, and I left off with this last week. We're going to kind of back up and hit this one more time. Where does this fall? When Jesus says this, I think we've got ourselves another, what we referred to last week as the master course stone, something sitting high up on the wall that kind of secures all the stones below it, and of which you can start to build on one more time. It's a point you've got to get this right. If you're building your eschatology and you hit this verse and it doesn't fit, then your layers below may be in error. You've got to put this in. It's got to fit. It's got to be the perfect stone that fits. And here it is. Verse 15 of Matthew 24. So, Jesus says, when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one go on the roof of his house, go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. And the reason he's saying that is because you're running for your lives. And there's going to be decisions you've got to make. I mean, you're just running. You're not even supposed to go get your coat if you're out in the field. You're not supposed to run home and make sure everything's fine. You'll turn off the electricity or the gas or pay your bills or something. Don't even come back in town. You see this happen, just start running. It's dangerous times. And woe to those people who've got other responsibilities like a small child or a pregnant woman. It's like, it's going to be difficult. In other words, let's go back and look at this. What is the sign? He says, so when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, and he even tells you where he gets the information, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. And I think that refers to the reader of the book of Daniel understand. In other words, if you're going to get this, you're going to have to go. He's telling you right here. He's telling you, if you're going to understand this, you're going to have to go back as the reader of Daniel and study it. You're going to have to get some understanding. And so we return to Daniel as we did last week. Please go to Daniel, please. We're going to do this one more time because I think I was rushing at the end. And again, this is a fairly important verse. There are four times in Daniel that this abomination is referred to. And there's basically three points in history where you can place this abomination of desolation taking place. And again, as always, I'm going to try and do the best I can of putting this together, but there's probably going to be other options, and there's always someone on the fringe saying, well, this could be true also. And we got to leave that open, and we got to leave those options open because we're talking about eschatology. So I'll try and make this as clear as possible. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 13, we have a reference here to the sanctuary, the abomination of being desolate, being desecrated. And what we're talking about here is the Jews had a temple that was destroyed in 70 AD. They tried to rebuild it in 132 AD and led to the second Jewish revolt. They tried to build it again around 450, 460 in that time. During the days of Julian the Apostate, they started building it again, and it didn't succeed. The Jews have always tried to rebuild their temple. By that time, by 400 AD, they were, you know, pretty weak. And by 600, the Muslims have come in and taken control. And you got the Crusaders, you got all church history. And the Jews just have not had a chance to go back there and rebuild their temple. Now, if it's eschatologically important or not, that's another question. I'm just telling you history. They try to rebuild it in 132. They try to rebuild it late in the 400s. They've continually wanted to rebuild it. And they're ready now to rebuild it. In fact, we were talking, I don't remember what we said last week, but I've seen the material that they're planning on putting in the temple, the one that they're ready to build. If for some reason they says we're in this little shop area, it's not a big place, it's a small area, but it's a few small rooms. Did I tell you this last week? No? Okay. I'm sorry. Someone that would be more alert and younger would have a sharper mind maybe. But we went to this, it's called the Temple Institute. You can Google it, the Temple Institute. It sounds like really something impressive, and it is. They've collected money from around the world to build the temple. They're ready to build the temple. And they said at this, when I signed up, I went there once in 2007 by myself and found a tour going through. There's a German group, so everything was said in German. So I missed, I just saw stuff, people holding stuff, pointing at stuff. It's like, well, we caught them with an English tour this last time, and Tony and I went with them. And they had like the candelabra, the candle stand that's going to be in this new temple. If they build it, if they don't, whatever, you know, wherever your eschatology comes out, the Jews are ready to build the temple. And I was sitting in the front row, so they said, come up here. And I held in my hand one of the lamp stands. It was made out of gold, but it was heavy, heavier than I expected. And they had seven lampstands sitting on this menorah that's going to go in the temple. And I was the one holding it. We couldn't take pictures. Otherwise, you know, there'd be pictures on Facebook. They're ready. Right there on the side, they had a stone altar that they'd built. It was sitting on skids, ready to be picked up with a forklift and taken to the Temple Mount. They're going to build a more appropriate altar when they get there, but with that altar made out of uncut stones, just like they did in the Old Testament, like Elijah would have used, it's ready to be picked up by a forklift, taken to the Temple Mount, set. And if they signed a treaty, they said They says, we're ready to go. They said, we don't know how we're going to get access to the Temple Mount again, but we will. They says, it could be an earthquake, it could be a treaty, it could be a war, but we are ready. And they said, if they sign a treaty today, this is what the Jews were saying. If we sign a treaty today, we could be offering the evening sacrifices this afternoon. And right, this would go up there, everything would be set up, and they'd begin functioning. And of course, then they begin building all the structures. So the Jews are ready to build this temple again. If it's going to happen like that, who knows? You know, I mean, you got to read your Bible, you got to read eschatology and watch things take place. Nonetheless, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the temple, the sanctuary. And it's got to be holy. Only priests can go into the most holy place, and that's once a year. Only priests can go into the holy place, which is the outer sanctuary where the lamp stands, everything stands. Obviously, a Gentile can hold it today because it's not been sanctified yet. But once it's set there, you'll never see it again as a Gentile in their view. And other things that will have to be set up, especially the altar out front where they offer the sacrifices, the animal sacrifice. It has to be clean according to the law. To desecrate it would be to do something against their rituals, such as Antiochus Epiphanes in 165, 168, probably let's say 168. He came in, a Gentile, a Greek, one of Alexander's general's descendants coming out of Syria. He came in and offered pig on it. He offered, set up an image to Zeus with his own face on it, you know, and then offered a pig on this altar. Shut the temple down. The Jews are like, well, we can't use that. They've got to now purify. They've got to clean everything. So he desecrated the temple, set up an image, a pagan image, and offered pig meat on an altar. So that was how he desecrated. Now we're looking in Daniel chapter 4. Jesus just referred to when you see the abomination of desolation set up in the holy place. And that is referring to the holy place where the Ark of the Covenant is, or the holy place where the lampstand is, possibly even out in the front if you want to stretch it. It could be out there by the altar in the outer court again. But somewhere in that area, there's going to be a desecration take place. It has happened, in a sense, in our talk today. It's happened in the Maccabean Revolt in 168 B.C. It happened again, you could say, when Pompey came in 63 B.C., came in and he wanted to see some stuff, went back there to see it, and there's nothing in the holy place. He just kind of walked back there and looked, and there was nothing there. And then you've got the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. We'll refer to that again. And then you have potentially this future event, because there's no temple today. There's been no temple since 70 AD. There's been no place to be desecrated since 70 AD. So this could not have happened from 70 AD up until today. So it could possibly happen in the future if this temple is rebuilt. This is part of the discussion on eschatology. So here we go. Here's your four references in Daniel chapter 8, verse 13 is your first one. I'll begin in verse 13. Then I heard a holy one, Daniel chapter 8, verse 13, a holy one or an angel speaking, and another holy one said to him, how long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled, the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, and the surrender of the sanctuary and of the host that will be trampled underfoot? He said to me, it will take 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. They'll reestablish it. This right here, without going into another whole big spiel on history and everything here, that desolation that was the altar that was reestablished, the temple was reestablished or reconsecrated, is, especially when you say 2,300 evenings and mornings, is probably referring to, and most people would agree with this, is the Maccabean Revolt, Antiochus Epiphanes in 168. That has already happened, okay? We got another reference. Let's go to Daniel chapter 11, verse 31. This is review from last week. Daniel 11, verse 31. Here's another. Remember, Jesus says, as spoken by the prophet Daniel. So we've got to get into these pages and find what was he talking about. And again, as I'm reading this, realize Jesus is speaking in 30 A.D. So it's very unlikely, it'd make no sense if he's talking about a past event that happened two centuries before that time, you know, in the 160s B.C. So he's not trying to predict the invasion of Antiochus Epiphanes. That would be completely worthless. But here's another one, Daniel chapter 11, verse 31. I'm looking in verse 29. At the appointed time, I'm in Daniel 11, verse 29, I'll tell you ahead of time. Daniel 11 is all about the time period from the Persian kings that Daniel is reigning under or living under, all the way up until Antiochus Epiphanes revolt. It covers like 400 years of history during this chapter 11. And this is one of the reasons why the liberal scholars, and I can name them to you right now, they despise me. They do not like my teaching because I put this in, and I've had people walk out of Bible studies in West Des Moines because I taught this literally. They came to hear me teach, and I taught this literally, and they shake their head and walk out because I'm teaching this as if it was prophesied by Daniel about future events. And they say this was not written by Daniel. This was written by some pseudo-writer, some false writer during the days of the Maccabean revolt. They just pretended. It was like political propaganda, just kind of encourage the people as they're being invaded by the Greeks and all these bad things are happening. They go, quick, we're losing the people. We've got to encourage them. So they wrote this all down, and they just pretended to be predicting all of the history that they already knew, and this made it sound like it's all going to work out in the end. Just stay with us. It's all going to work out in the end. And it was, in other words, it's a forgery in their churches. It's a lie. It's not written by Daniel. And then when Jesus says, as spoken by the prophet Daniel, how far off base is Daniel? Well, Jesus just playing along with the people's understanding. It's like, now you're losing me. I mean, if I'm a Christian and you're teaching that way about the Bible, I am not going to spend evenings studying this thing. I'm not going to drive all the way across the state trying to teach this. It's kind of like, whatever, it's a forgery. Jesus was just playing along with the people believed. He's probably just playing along with us. Believe whatever you want to. He'll just play along with you. So I see, I don't really go well in that camp, you see. But nonetheless, I think this is Daniel prophesying these events that took place. And in verse 29, at the appointed time, which would be 168 B.C., he, and that's Antiochus Epiphanes, will invade the south again, but this time his outcome will be different from that before. Ships from the western coastland, that's Rome, the rise of Rome coming, and this happened, you can read historically, this just fits perfectly with historical accounts. He's in Egypt, Antiochus Epiphanes, he's lost a battle, and Rome is coming. They pull their ships up, they get out, they draw a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes, the general of the Romans, and says, you decide what you're going to do. Are you going to fight us or are you going to retreat? He says, I'll think about it. He says, I'll get back to you tomorrow. And the general of Rome drew a circle around him in the sand there on the beach as their ships, and this is history now, now we're in history, drew a circle around Antiochus and says, you decide before you leave that circle. And he was humiliated. And of course, he had to retreat. He went back and had realized he had to get Jerusalem under control and began to raid Israel, use that as a base, a military base, so he could attack Egypt again. And that's what's right here. It says, ships from the western coastland will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Yeah, when they drew the circle around, it says, what are you going to do? The big man now is humiliated. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. That's Jerusalem. Now you can see why someone who doesn't really believe in the supernatural would have a hard time believing that Daniel is prophesying this stuff in such great detail. But if you believe in the supernatural, you believe in a God that sees eternity, history from the point of eternity, it's not a big deal. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant, who turn their back on Moses. Verse 31, his armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress. Now notice what it's called there, temple fortress. Because it was a temple, a worship place, but it's a very strong structure, and so the people would use it as a fortress in times of need. They'd use it as a military base. Desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. He's trying to snuff out the covenant in 168, 167 B.C. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. That's that statue to Zeus. Put pig's blood on the altar. With flattery, he'll corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. In other words, the people who know this word, that know this history, know Daniel chapter 11, at that time, they'll say, this is exactly what's, we're not going to go for this. This is not right. We're going to firmly resist you because we know our God. Now, this is the power of prophecy. It's not the speculation, the writing of books and all this stuff, although you've got to do that. The power of it is that when these things take place, you can say, this is it. We know where we are at. And you can firmly resist the evil that is coming against you because God has specifically told you, this is the evil I was talking about. And Jesus is taught, that's what Jesus is telling his disciples. We could talk more about that. But clearly, I think, you can decide for yourself, that was 168 B.C. That's already been fulfilled. So that's two of the four have already been fulfilled. I now go to Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. And now we're in that prophecy of the angel coming to Daniel saying, there has been 490 years decreed for your people Israel. or 77s. And there's really no debate on that. I mean, you can try to, you know, do something, but it's anybody who's honest about their interpretation here. 77s, we're in Daniel chapter 9, verse 24. 77s are 490 years, are decreed for the people of Israel. The question's going to come, when do you start counting those 490 years? I even had a conversation with one of the a very great Jewish man over there in Jerusalem about this right here. And they've got it dated. They've got it figured out. It fits in with their eschatology. Of course, it doesn't include Christ. It includes Cyrus and some other things. But that's another conversation. But they've had to navigate their way through this too. But 77s are decreed for your people, Israel, and your holy city, Jerusalem, to finish transgression. It gives you a list of things that are going to take place in those 490 years, which we could talk about at some point. Verse 25, know and understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens, or there will be 69 of those sevens will take place from the time they issue a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until your anointed one, the Christ, that means Messiah in the Hebrew, the Messiah, the ruler, comes. So there's 483 years right there. And again, you say, why do you got the 62 and the 7 break there, 7 sevens and 62 sevens? That would be right there when as the Old Testament was finished. That's about the time of Nehemiah, Ezra, and the Old Testament is wrapping up. They seal that, and then you begin the next period of years. That's probably what that break is, the 63 sevens and the 7 sevens. But nonetheless, we continue, please. But it says right here, until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. And again, I'm not going to try to teach you all the details and throw all the charts up here, and there's a variety of ways of doing it. But a simple counting of Artaxerxes issuing the decree to restore Jerusalem and counting down puts you right at 20. I mean, without doing any kind of leap year and solar years and 360 days, 365 days, all this kind of stuff, you know, and teacher in services and everything you got to figure into the schedule. It all comes down to, it hits 26 A.D. It's 26 A.D., which, again, you can adjust that a few weeks or years, you know, depending on how you want to do solar years and prophecy calendars and stuff. But nonetheless, that's when John the Baptist began his ministry. You can tweak it to the place that it falls exactly on Palm Sunday when Jesus walks in. And I did that back in the 80s, tweaked it. You can count right to the day where Jesus walks in and says, if you had only known what day it was, but now it's your temple's left you desolate. I mean, it's like this was the day, click, here's your Messiah, and we don't want him. And that's what takes place right here. It says, until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. Now understand, this right here puts Jesus, this is not Antiochus Epiphanes, this is now Jesus. Now you're into 30 A.D. So that now, if we have that desolation, it's got to take place after Jesus. Now we're in a verse that's talking about what Jesus is talking about, the desolation. It will be rebuilt, the city will be rebuilt with streets and a trench. Streets means a marketplace, basically, and a trench means military defense, meaning it's a market city, a city that's up and functioning with a military defense system. This is a successful city. But in times of trouble, yeah. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off. When he comes in and says, here I am, ta-da, they kill him. They cut him off. That means to be violently removed. And will have nothing. The king, the ruler, comes and gets zero. Jesus was the king. He came and didn't get the kingdom. They wouldn't give it to him. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now again, if Jesus being cut off in 30 AD is right here, then after him what happens? The ruler of the people who comes will destroy the city and the sanctuary. That's clearly 70 AD when the temple was destroyed. The end will come like a flood. Now, what does that mean? I think as flood water, again, I'm just throwing this out. I'm not going to go to everything we can do with this. But I think it basically means it will come like a flood, just like water. Here comes the flood. You can't stop it. It just keeps moving. It doesn't mean fast necessarily. It doesn't necessarily mean destructive necessarily. It just means here comes the end. It's just like here, you've ever seen flood water. It's like here they come. They can tell you how high the river is going to be at 12 o'clock today because of where it's at. It's coming this way. Nothing's going to stop the flood. And the history is going to come like a flood. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. There's going to be wars. Jesus says, even in Matthew 24, there'll be wars and rumors of wars. There'll be desolations. There's going to be famines. There's going to be earthquakes. As history's coming, it's just going to continue to move. There's going to be famines. There's going to be desolations. There's going to be war. History's just going to unfold. And then it says, he Again, now there's a pronoun. That he is just hanging there. Who is he? I mean, when you get into this, you've got to, that's a huge area of study. Who is he? He will confirm a covenant with many. Now that he could be the anointed one, the Messiah, which we just called Jesus. So Jesus could confirm a covenant with many. Or the he could be, you go back to the verse right before it, the people of the ruler who will come. The he, I think, and again, you're free to study, the he is the ruler who will come. So the people of the ruler who's coming, and wherever that ruler, and again, okay, I'll just throw it out at you, he is the Antichrist, I think. And he, the Antichrist, is going to confirm a covenant with men. He's going to make a treaty. And who is he? He is the ruler of the people who will come. The people who are good are the people of the ruler who will come. The people from Syria destroyed the temple, which indicates possibly, just throwing this out there, the Antichrist will come out of Syria. Not hard to imagine, but play with that for a while. Anyway, this Antichrist, whoever he is, will confirm a covenant with many, which would mean with Israel, but possibly also with other nations, for 1-7, or the final seven, the final week that lasts 7 years. So click, 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 Jesus is killed. That ends the 483 years. There's still one period of 7 years left. It didn't. So if you're preterist, you put that all into Jesus' ministry in 70 AD. In fact, if you're preterist, here's what you do. He, are you ready? If you're preterist, don't raise your hands. If you're preterist, you would say this. He will confirm a covenant with many, and he is Jesus, and he confirms a covenant with many by dying on the cross and puts an end to the sacrifices, which is exactly what happened. Jesus came, and at halfway point in his ministry, at the 3.5 year mark, he died on the cross, ending the covenant and establishing now a new covenant, and so we didn't need the temple. So that would be a very, we'd be like, hallelujah, verse 27 is a glorious verse. He, Jesus, confirmed a covenant with many, the new covenant that we just celebrated. That's what we're talking about here if you're preterist, thinking all these things are fulfilled, with many, many people, all the nations of the world, for 1-7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to the sacrifice and offerings, and on a wing of the temple, he will set up the abomination that causes desolation until the end is decreed, is poured on him. And that gets a little greasy and slippery right there, because now you got Jesus setting up the abomination that causes desolation. But what that, they just play that, that's Rome. That's Jesus bringing Rome in to destroy the temple. And so now, that's if you want to go with this, and I think you're really, now you're getting way off base here, but and many people do, I think this is true, is this abomination was set up by the Romans in 70 AD when they destroyed the temple. Now again, the problem with this is here, is one, Rome never got there in time to set up an abomination in the temple in 70 AD. By the time Rome got there, it took them 5 months from April to August to get the city. It took them 4 years to get to Jerusalem, basically, 66 to 70 AD, and then 5 months to break through the walls, and it was such a madhouse in Jerusalem that the temple got set on fire. They were, apparently, according to Josephus, that the Romans wanted to keep the temple because it was one of the beautiful buildings of the ancient world. They didn't want it. It was a monument to how great they were. Look, we took this city, we destroyed the city, and this is the building we captured. But it caught on fire, there was a riots going on, and they lost control of it. So the Romans never set up an abomination, they never stopped the sacrifices, they never did that stuff. It just was on fire by the time they got there. So who would have been the one who caused this desolation? It would have been the Jews themselves. And that's going to happen in 68 AD, where you've got the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Zealots and the Tea Party and everybody fighting for control, and they're using the temple as a fortress, and someone would have gone in there and desecrated the temple. That would have been the desecration that they would be talking about. I just threw the Tea Party in there to be funny. That wasn't a political statement one way or the other. That was just Sunday morning, pay attention. And if you're taking notes and you wrote that down, just draw a line through the Tea Party. Okay, so anyway, this is either 70 AD, which it doesn't fit according to this teacher. So this would have to be a future event. So in Matthew 24, Jesus is either talking about the abomination that's set up in 68 AD, or he's talking about a yet future, which means now that temple has to be rebuilt. Again, you got to tread light. I've got ideas, but you've got to tread lightly with eschatology. We got one more verse we're going to look at, Daniel chapter 12, verse 11. This is the fourth mention of the abomination that causes desolation. And I think what we're doing here right now at this moment in time is we're doing what Jesus says. According to when he says, recorded by the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. You can't just start talking about what Jesus says in Matthew 24 in that verse until you go back to Daniel and see what was Daniel talking about. I think you've got to do this if you're going to move on. Daniel chapter 12, we're looking in verse 11. Now, this is the end of the book of Daniel. Let's begin in verse 8. Here, chapter 12, verse 8. This is Daniel speaking. And Daniel says, really, this is an important verse. Daniel says, the one who records this book says, I heard, but I did not understand. Now, that's why the more I study eschatology, the wimpier I become. Because it's like the more I see these things, there's so many different things happening and different avenues of putting things together. And then you read Jesus, you read the disciples, you read Daniel, you read even John. And in Revelation, it's like, I heard, but I did not understand. And they say, oh, well, that's okay, because I do understand. Galen understands. Let me explain it to you. Listen, if Daniel saw the vision, Daniel wrote it down, and at the end of the book, he's still saying, hey, I got some questions yet. And the angels are going to say, that's okay, Daniel. You don't need to understand. Just write it down. I mean, we've got, at some point, we've got to study it. We've got to know it. We've got to go through it, make our charts. But then at the same time, it's like, just make sure it's there. I think one of the important things is, like Jesus says, you see, I told you ahead of time. So that when these things start to transpire, you see, here they are. And if for no other reason, our purpose as our at this generation, this time in history, is to take these things, study these things, write about it, teach about it, and hand them to the next generation, because there's a generation coming, if I'm correct, is going to see these things transpire. And they're not going to, well, we're going to see in Jesus here talk about it, they're not going to need necessarily a Bible teacher to stand up and explain it to them, because it's like, they're looking at it. Like the disciples are going to say, what is the sign of your coming? I'm jumping back to Matthew 24, just in a reference here. They said to Jesus, what is the sign of your coming? And Jesus says, it's like lightning is from the east to the west. The sign of my coming is my coming. You're not going to, when he says, come out here in the wilderness or come in here in the inner room, it's like, don't go with them. You're not going to need a mystic explaining, I had a vision. Jesus has returned to Audubon. Come to Audubon. And if you pray and squint your eyes, you can see him appear in the clouds. It's like, that's not how it's going to be. Well, no, he's over here. We found him here. Or he came back. The preterists say he came back as the Romans. The Romans were Jesus' return. That was the return of the Son of God. It's like, okay. But Jesus says he'll be like lightning from the east to the west. You won't need anybody to tell you. You don't need a Bible teacher. You don't need CNN. You don't need a news report. It's like everyone, Revelations begins. Every eye will see him. Everyone, it's like you don't need a teacher on that day to tell you, I think Jesus is back. It's like everyone knows. So anyway, here we go. Chapter 12, verse 8 of Daniel. Chapter 12, verse 8. Daniel says, I heard, but I did not understand. So I asked, my Lord, what will the outcome of all this be? I want you to notice again, after the whole book of Daniel, Daniel asks, where is this going? After Jesus teaches his disciples, in Acts chapter 1, they say, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? And Jesus says, it's not for you to know. They don't give even, Daniel's not done with class. I teach class several times a week. When I get done with class, sometimes I shut the video camera off and class goes for another half hour. Because why? Questions. I try to answer because I'm a teacher and I'm arrogant. I try to act like I know what I'm talking about. But here, the book of Daniel and Jesus' ministry to his disciples both end with, that's enough questions. I've given you the information. That's you're not going to understand any more than that. And it's kind of, you know, disappointing, kind of relieving, but watch this again. I heard but didn't understand, so I asked, my Lord, what will the outcome of all this be? He replied, go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. We could talk about that if we wanted to. Many will be purified, made spotless, and refined. Again, those are three great verses. It means examined, cleansed, and fused. Meaning they're going to be examined, they're going to be tested, and they're going to be cast into a new image. But the wicked will continue to be wicked because they'll want nothing to do with the process. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that, here it is, here's the last thing they say. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,335th days. Those are not just empty numbers. Again, I'll throw this at you like a ton of bricks and just catch what you can. Good luck. In Revelation, it talks about the last 3.5 years being 1,260 days. From the halfway point until the end, 1,260 days. That is the second half of the what we'd say the tribulation, the second half of Daniel's 70th week. It's 1,260 days. It's 42 months times 30 days is 1,260 days. The Bible records time, times, and half a time. It records 42 months. It records time, or it records 1,260 days. Okay, now it says, from the time it is set up until from the time that abomination is set up until it is removed will be 1,290 days. So it appears there's a 30-day period between the time, if we'd say Christ returns, and 30 days before that whole mess is cleared up in the Temple Mount. In other words, you've got a 30-day purification process. The Maccabees went through the same thing with Judas Maccabeus when they came in and they took control of the Jerusalem again. They had to cleanse the temple. That's what we celebrate as, what people celebrate as Hanukkah. We should consider celebrating because it's a great historical event, but not like that's enough of that, but it's a great historical event. Hanukkah is the celebration of the cleansing of the temple after Judas or Antiochus Epiphanes. So this would be right here, 1,290 days of cleansing the temple, and then blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,335 days. That would be an additional 45-day period. And we're heading there in Matthew 25. Notice this word right here. Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the 1,335th day. If you go with the way I've got my eschatology set up right here, right now, is you've got the return of Christ, you've got a 30-day period of cleansing and getting everything set up right, and then you've got the period of the judgment, of judging the nations. What Matthew talks about, the sheep and goat judgment, and brings them in on the right and on the left and judges the survivors there on the earth. If you just stay with me, you don't have to agree with this. But no, what does he say to the ones on his right? He says, blessed are you, welcome to my Father's kingdom, prepared for you since the beginning of the time or beginning of the earth. And right here, blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the 1,335th. You're blessed if you make it through that judgment and you're welcomed into the kingdom. There may be a direct connection there. That's what those numbers mean. Nonetheless, those are your four references to the abomination of desolation that Daniel spoke about. So it's either, I think, Antiochus Epiphanes, and we got two of those very clear, I think, from 168 BC, or Rome coming in 70 AD, which is really, it slips through your fingers, I think. Preterists don't think so. They think I'm crazy. But if you go off into the future, it's a future event. So let's go back to Matthew chapter 24, please. Matthew 24, and read these verses. That kind of sets a base. I'm trying to get some ground covered. Look at that was the introduction. I just summarized what I covered the last 5 minutes on Sunday last week. So you understand. That's how terrible a job of teaching that was. You're like, 45 minutes of information in 5 minutes. And I thought, that was pretty good, wasn't it? It's like, okay, no. Okay, we're in Matthew 24, kind of where we left off somewhere. We've gone through, the disciples have asked, what is the sign of your coming parousia? Not in Luke, not in Mark, that word. You don't have to make a big deal about it, but it is a word used by Paul and throughout the New Testament as a technical term for the arrival of the King, Jesus. It's a word, a technical term used throughout the Greek world for the arrival of a king, a delegate, or somebody coming to the city of importance. Verse 15, so when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, and of course that's not Antiochus Epiphanes, that's past, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. And now the reader understands, at least, because we've looked at all four of them. Two of them are Antiochus Epiphanes, two of them are still hanging there. One after the 483rd year, we've just talked about that. Let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Okay? Now, this is what he's saying right there. When you see this, this is bad news. When you see someone enter your temple and set up some other image and desecrate your temple, this is bad. Get out of town. How fast should we get out of town? Don't negotiate, don't talk, don't get a good night's sleep and leave tomorrow, don't fill up with gas. Go. If you're in the field, you went to work that day, and you left your family at home, and you hear it's happened, and when you hear this, and again, has this happened? I don't know. Has it? But when you hear this, if you hear this in the future, and you're out in the field, you're out working, you went to work, don't go back and check on your family. There's no time. That's hard. That's harsh words right there. Don't. Why would you go back home to shut off the TV? I would go back home to say, come on, we got to get everybody out of town. Too late. You're not leaving. You'd better been prepared ahead of time. Or if you're in the house, up on the roof, a lot of times they go up on the roof in the daytime, even go up on the roof even now, you walk across, we went through, just walk from roof to roof, walk across town taking pictures. We got some pictures, just fun times, you know. But people go up on the roof at night and sit up on the roofs and different things. If you're up on the roof and then there'll be stairways coming down the side of the house, don't go down into your house and get your coat and then leave. If you're on the roof and you hear about it, take off. And then, of course, right here, it says, let no one who is in the field go back to take his cloak, verse 18, verse 19. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers, because you can't just run away. You can't just leave the baby sleeping. You're out in the field, you're going to go back and get the baby. It's like Jesus says, those are days of tough decisions. You go back, it's a lose-lose situation. You run, it's a lose-lose situation. How dreadful it will be in those days, because it's happening fast. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter, which will make it even more complicated. Imagine trying to flee today, you know, go down interstate, and all the trucks are jackknifed in the ditch, and it's like, hurry faster, faster. You can't. Hope it's not in the winter. And on a Sabbath, because on a Sabbath, it's going to make things even more difficult. One, the gates are closed, you know, Quick Trip's not open, there's no one, nothing's open, you're just, and then it's real obvious, because some are going to be staying, and some are going to be fleeing. So you're fleeing on a Sabbath, and there's a limit on how far you can walk on a Sabbath. And you can't just do a Sabbath day's walk and say, well, this is good for today. You're going to have to break the Sabbath to get out of town. And then as you break the Sabbath, it's going to be very clear to everyone, you're not really on board with it. There's going to be a public stigma right there. I think you're one of those. So nonetheless, what about? Now, very quickly, this, I think, is a future event. And those that will live through this should know this, you see. Jesus is going to say in just a minute, see, I've told you ahead of time. Now, if that's 70 A.D., my friends, Luke says the same thing. Luke, we could flip over there, but for the sake of time, we won't. Luke says the same thing. He says, Jesus says, and Luke records, so when you see Jerusalem surrounded by its enemies, get out of town. Flee. And that is exactly what the early Christians did. Because in 168, Vespasian has arrived to Jerusalem. Now we're talking about, you understand, we're talking about two things. We're talking about the preterist view, which is true to an extent, because upon this generation, these things will happen. But then there's the future side too. In 68 AD, beginning in 66 AD, Rome swept from Galilee, coming down into Judea. By 68 AD, they are in Judea, ready to begin their siege on Jerusalem, or begin the taking Judea. And amazingly, at this time, Nero kills himself. The emperor kills himself, and so there's chaos in Rome. Trickles down, and so Vespasian backs off, and at that time, history records, the Christians, knowing the book of Luke, packed up, took off. They went across the Jordan to the east side of the Jordan to Moab, and then went up into Ammon, up into Decapolis, a place called Apella, up there into the hill country. And that's where they stayed from 68 AD until 73 AD. And then they all just came back and reestablished Jerusalem, built churches, and Christianized Jerusalem. The Jews stayed and fought, waiting for their Messiah. They fought courageously because they knew their Messiah was going to show up. He did 40 years ago, and you killed him. But the Christians who accepted Christ, when they saw Jerusalem surround the city, when Nero died, Vespasian backed off to wait for further orders. What are we doing? There was a break in the action, and all the Christians left. So this was fulfilled at that time. But again, so I mean, you can say, well, it's already fulfilled. I think it's a future fulfillment. Okay, we continue verse 21. For then there will be great distress unequaled from the beginning of the world until now. Again, Jerusalem's destruction was tremendous, but I think it was, I mean, it's happened in other cities since and before. And never to be equaled again. I think that's a future day. In other words, these are terrible times that are coming. The next 3.5 years will be terrible. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. Now, there's an interesting verse right there of how will those days be shortened. And I'm out of time here, obviously. I've got five things written down. There's five. What does he mean, those days are shortened? Days are shortened. Does he cut the tribulation? Could his tribulation have gone on for 10 years? He cuts it back to 3.5 years. Does he cut the persecution short? And so that, you know, there's some event takes place and judgment from God begins, cutting back the judgment. I may have to pick this up next week and continue talking about this. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. So for those who are the believers, the faithful that are there waiting for him, those days are cut short. We continue on here. We got this next week. If those days had not been cut short, No one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. If anyone has to tell you, oh, look, we found him, that's not right. In other words, what will be the sign of your coming? It will not be, look, I think we found him. Because everyone will be saying at the same time, they'll all be saying, look, there he is. That's the sign. Look, the sign is, in a sense, there is no sign. Everyone will already know. A sign is to make people wonder and ask and perceive it. The sign is Jesus coming back. There he is. Do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. See, I have told you ahead of time. And we go to 2 Thessalonians there. We'll pick this up next week. And there in 2 Thessalonians, we see the exact same correlation of the false signs that deceive those who are not elect, deceive those who have forsaken the truth. And why are they deceived? It says, because they rejected the truth. If you reject the truth, you're still looking for the truth. But if you rejected the truth, the only thing you can find is an alternative to the truth, which we call a lie. And that's the problem. They know they're looking for something, but they've rejected the truth. That's going to happen in a variety of ways in life, but the Jews did a classic job of that in 30 AD and 70 AD, or 30 AD and 66 AD, when they rejected Jesus Christ. And what did they continue to do? When they rejected Jesus as the Messiah, what did they continue to do? They continue to look for their Messiah. Well, whoever you find is going to be wrong. And they found someone, the zealots pushed them forward, and they got everybody motivated, and they decided they could fight Rome, which they just stepped into the trap. They were deceived. And there you see the elect right there, they left in 70 AD, and those that rejected Christ, they stayed to fight for the falsehood. And the same thing will take place in the future. We'll pick this up next week. I do appreciate your patience. Of course, we didn't get as far as I wanted to, but I hope that was a little clearer. I want to move through Matthew 24 and 25. I don't want to spend weeks talking about eschatology. But at the same time, I'm trying to cover those verses so they're not just confusing. And realize there's many different, there's different ways of putting those things together and reading them. And it takes time and it takes study. Father, we do thank you for your truth. We thank you for the opportunity to look into these things. We ask that we may continue to grow, that we may continue to pursue your truth. We thank you for giving us these ancient words that we can have today and for future generations can continue to use them for guidance in their lives. We ask that we may do a good service today to provide the truth to our generation, but also to hand it down to the next generation. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.